Today I have the great pleasure of introducing another extraordinary guest. It's Lynn McTaggart. Lynn is one of the preeminent spokespersons on consciousness, the new physics and the science of spirituality. She is the award-winning journalist and author of 5 books, including the worldwide bestsellers The Intention Experiment and The Field, both considered seminal books in their genre. She's the co-founder and editorial director of the highly praised newsletter What Doctors Don't Tell You, and has spoken before many diverse audiences around the world and is regularly on television and radio in many countries. Lynn is also the architect of the Intention Experiment, which is a web-based global laboratory involving an international consortium of prestigious scientists and thousands of people in countries around the world to test the power of intention to heal the world. And the study has conducted periodic large-scale experiments to determine whether the focused intention of our readers has an effect on scientifically quantifiable targets in various laboratories around the globe. These studies, in effect, constitute the largest mind-over-matter experiments in history. Lynn, a very warm welcome to you today. We're honoured to have you, and thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you.
Fantastic. So one of the key aims of the summit is to help both practitioners and patients just generally understand the research of physics and consciousness better and how it applies to health. And just starting with your book, The Field, you documented a tremendous amount of evidence behind what we'd call the human energy body. You called it The Field, has different names. I would just say that that book is essential reading for anybody who wants to get more understanding about how the science of physics applies to health. So I just wanted to thank you again, even now, for writing that book and enlightening so many people, and I'm sure many more to come. So we've had speakers cover various aspects of the field that you talk about in the book. We had Dr. Roland McCratie talking about the electromagnetic field around the heart. We've had speakers on the electric body. But I just wanted to ask you about one aspect of the book, which is the work of Fritz Albert Popp, as I still think a lot of people don't understand his work, haven't heard about it. It's one of my favourite bits of the book, and many others, people have said the same. And I'd just be interested for you to share, I presume you met him when you did your research for that book. Who was he and what did he discover and the implications?
Fritz Albert Popp was a German physicist. He died last April, by the way, a year ago this past April, and it's a great sad loss for the world because he was an amazing genius. He discovered that there was a strange property of certain elements that seemed to change when they were exposed to the body, or the body seemed to do something to them. So he wondered whether or not there must be some sort of light coming from the body. So he began doing experiments and created equipment that demonstrated that indeed all living things, including human beings, send out a tiny current of light. It's like a little tiny Morse code of light emissions. Moreover, he found that when living things send out light, other living things respond with their light synchronicitously. So it's like we're having a light conversation. He also discovered that this light is coming from DNA. And so he wondered whether or not this may be the guiding principle of the body that is conducting all of its processes. Because one of the things that still confuses biologists, no one can figure out why we differentiate how a single cell can turn into the complex mechanism that is a human being. And how do certain cells know to be an arm and certain cells know to be a leg? And also, how do we account for all of the chemical processes that happen in the body simultaneously? Hundreds and hundreds of them happening at every moment in order for us to generate happiness, fear, sadness, joy, all of those things. The usual explanation, the materialist explanation, is that chemicals find each other through what is called the lock and key theory, which is they bump into each other, essentially. And I always like to liken a cell to a swimming pool, and with certain molecules inside it that are like a couple of tennis balls. And so what you're really saying is that one tennis ball will somehow find another tennis ball in the swimming pool simultaneously. So, of course, that doesn't really work very well. It doesn't really explain things. And what Popp realized and he experimented with was demonstrating that, for instance, when you put some medicine on your hand, the light will change there that's coming out, but it will also change everywhere else in the body. So he theorized that the light must be a sort of global conductor of the body. So in a sense, it has two functions. It's a means of communication through the whole of the body and helps to affect chemical processes of all sorts. And it also is a global communication with the world. And so we are sending out and we're receiving all the time. We are, as I like to call it, leaky buckets. We're sending and receiving at every moment.
Fantastic. Hugely interesting. He also did experiments that I thought was just very interesting with raw versus cooked and processed foods, didn't he? And he also found that the raw aspects of foods actually had more light emissions than processed food.
Yes, different light emissions, because he found cooking changes the light. Let me make something really clear about this light, too. There's a kind of perfect equilibrium that when you have a healthy body. More is not always better. For instance, people with MS generate too much light. And with cancer victims, they have too little light. It's like their light's going out. So what Pop discovered is that sometimes when a being is stressed of any sort, the light goes up. So the key is to keep that perfect equilibrium of light.
Fascinating. And although this is still not accepted in mainstream, it's increasingly coming out. I mean, there was Poponin's phantom DNA experiment, where he shone a laser light at DNA and it seemed to keep the light in the DNA, even when the physical DNA was taken away, which is amazing. But then things like, just to back up what you're saying there, things like shining, there were Harvard researchers that shone a light at you could regrow teeth from cells by shining a laser light. So clearly light contains information that's telling biology what to do.
Yes, that's exactly it. And Pop started out, he was completely on his own. He was ostracized. He was thrown out of the university where he was working. He was treated like a criminal at first for even suggesting such heresy. But by the time of his death, there were 40 or 50 scientists around the world working on his material, replicating it, and agreeing with him. And it had come to be accepted in very advanced circles. So I think we'll find, as with a number of the other scientists in the field who are now gone, like Jacques Benveniste, who I also talked about, who was really responsible for recognizing that molecules send out a unique electromagnetic frequency, and it is that really creates some of these chemical processes. These guys are all amazing pioneers, and it will be discovered, you know, it's science changes one funeral at a time, as they say, and the funerals of these two people are going to be recognized as being, you know, really amazing turning points in 50 years or so.
Very interesting. That's a recurring theme on this summit about research that's not going to hit the standard physician on the street for 30 to 50 years. So it's a recurring theme. But so turning to a different aspect, this field has different ontological levels, I guess. So we have the electromagnetic parts that can be measured in different ways. And you talked about the biophoton field there, where they had a special machine that was created to measure those. But we still have this part of the field, the non-local field, the bit that we don't have the instruments to measure yet, I don't think. So if we talk about that non-local field, and I guess getting into the sort of quantum physics experiments, showing that we have part of it that is everywhere all the time, is completely interconnected to us, and we can impact it with consciousness. Maybe you could share quantum physics experiments and kind of what they found at the subatomic level.
Okay, let me first clarify one thing. We definitely can measure this field. We're talking about a quantum energy field, and quantum physicists have known about this for many, many years. In fact, since the advent of quantum physics, and I'll explain how it's generated. When subatomic particles, well, first of all, subatomic particles, we always depict them as billiard balls in physics classes. You know, we've got the atom and we have what looks like a solar system with lots of little subatomic particles like, you know, neutron and proton and electrons. But actually, they are more like vibrating packets of energy. And they emit energy themselves and share energy, almost like an endless game of tennis. So when two subatomic particles are near each other, they're sending energy back and forth. And in that energy exchange, they create what is called a virtual particle, which is like a particle that exists only for a fraction of a blink of an eye. Now, in that exchange, that's not much energy that's produced. It's like a half a watt's worth of energy. But if you tally up all of the subatomic particles doing this little particle exchange, this little tennis game, at every moment, you come up with this unbelievable, unfathomable amount of energy just sitting there in empty space like some supercharged backdrop. And just to give you an idea of how dense this is, if you were sitting 1 yard away from me, 1 meter away or so, the energy between us would be enough to boil all the oceans of the world. So we have this incredible, dense energy sitting out there in empty space, and of which we are a part, because our subatomic particles are also part of this energy dance. So we're talking about a quantum energy field. Now, the other thing you said was that we can't measure this. We can. I mean, scientists have been able to measure all sorts of things about non-locality. They've demonstrated in the laboratory, first of all, a couple of really amazing things about the subatomic world. One is that subatomic things aren't actually things yet. They are a potential of something. So let's imagine we have a big theater, a movie theater. And imagine that one subatomic particle is one chair in the theater. Actually, if you think about it in its potential self, it is like every seat in that theater all at the same moment. The only thing that turns that potential, so it exists as all potential selves all at once. The only thing that turns that possibility of something into something real, as scientists have discovered, is the observation of a scientist or someone. When they take a measurement or they actually observe the subatomic particle, it shrinks down from all possible cells into an actual something. They can then measure it almost like it's a particle. Then it's a particle they can locate it. And so they've discovered that. They've also discovered another really weird property about subatomic things, which is once two subatomic particles have come into contact, let's say, think of them like two twins that have been separated at birth. If you move one to New York and you keep the other one in London, even if they are never see each other again, since they've been in contact, they will continually be in contact. In fact, they will continue to affect each other. It's as though they both end up liking the color blue. They both end up marrying a woman called Jane. And if one falls down and breaks his leg, the other one will fall down at the same moment, even if he's just sitting there drinking a coffee in Starbucks. So it's like that constant effect all the time. They know about each other. They're affected by each other for all time, no matter how far you move them apart. So these weird effects, they've always believed, have been, the scientists have believed, are only a property of the subatomic world. You know, and once things get big enough to be seen, so they thought, they start behaving themselves and act according to Newtonian principles, which we all understand. You can't, you know, essentially are all about force. You know, one thing only affects something else by something physical being done to it. So you need to, if you're going to affect something, you need to freeze it, drop it, burn it, or give it a good swift kick. You know, but you have to do something physical to it, or so we thought. But the new science coming through, there's been a number of science studies done on clusters of molecules, some of the biggest ones in the world where you can actually see them. There's been studies on photosynthesis where they've discovered these quantum principles apply. So it may well be that this is not just a rule book for the quantum world, but the rule book for all of life, and that we are subject to quantum rules ourselves. And that's increasingly being seen to be the case. And certainly that's been demonstrated in a lot of the experiments I've done.
Fascinating. And that is leading very interestingly to perhaps you could share a bit about some of the original work done at Princeton by the Princeton researchers on how, so these, the physics experiments showed us that the observer effect, and that affected what was going on at a subatomic level. So at Princeton, they started to show how our consciousness can affect things at the gross level. And perhaps you could share, starting with that and then leading on to your own work.
Sure. There have been many, many studies of the power of the human mind to affect the physical world. There have been thousands of studies, hundreds of thousands of studies, showing that mind can affect everything from single-celled organisms to full-fledged human beings. And these are good studies done in the laboratory by prestigious scientists in prestigious universities. One of the most compelling was a body of evidence and research carried out by then Dean of Engineering at Princeton University, Robert John, and his assistant, Brenda Dunn, who's a psychologist. Now, the two of them designed a program to see whether or not people can affect sensitive equipment like computers. So they designed what is called a random event generator. And this is essentially an electronic toss of the coin. So imagine that, and what they would usually configure it as, is two images that come up alternately on the computer screen. So, for instance, one was cowboys and the other was Indians. And because these were randomly controlled processes, Indians would show up about half the time and cowboys would show up about half the time. So the images would flash back and forth. So they would sit operators in front of these computers and ask them to will the machine to show more cowboys than Indians, or vice versa. And they ran these experiments hundreds of thousands of times with hundreds of different operators. And they discovered a small but consistent trend that when people sent intention to get more cowboys than Indians or whatever the computer configuration was, they would. And so there was a, you know, and when you compound all of these experiments together, you get an enormously significant effect. For instance, looking at the effect size of, and it was called the Princeton Engineering Anomalous Research Program. And when you look at all of their studies combined together, you find that the results of the effect size, that means the rate of change, is 10 times bigger than aspirin, which is considered one of the most successful drugs of all time. So it was a powerful, powerful result showing that mind can affect matter.
Amazing. And perhaps that's a good segue into also talking about your own, the intention experiments, and perhaps sharing some of your research that you've discovered with your readers.
Okay. So what we found was that, you know, what I found after looking at all of this research, and I looked at studies of healing, I looked at studies of intention on other, lots of other things. I mean, there have been brilliant studies showing that, you know, intention can make gerbils go faster on their activity wheels or make fish swim in a certain direction. I mean, there have been some very, very ingenious studies. And of course, there have been about 150 studies, good studies, showing that mind can heal other people. So I was really interested in what happens with a mass of people. What happens if lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time? Does that compound the effect? And I also wanted to find out how far can we take this? You know, there's so many discussions about intention. The word is used so lightly all the time, you know. Everybody talks about intention these days. It's a big buzzword. Even Jane Fonda once talked about mothering with intention. So I wanted to see, okay, so what can we do with this? And if this is so powerful, can we use it to heal the world? So I started a program with my fifth book, The Intention Experiment, which was to have an ongoing experiment. And I know lots of scientists at very important universities, and I also have lots of readers because my books are in 30 languages. So I thought, well, if I put them together, I'm going to have the biggest global laboratory in the world. And that's what we've been doing since 2007. We've done studies looking at changing biological, simple biological systems, seeing if we can change those tiny light emissions. We started out taking big baby steps because we thought, well, nobody's ever done this before, so we better start small and grow and, you know, slowly grow and slowly make it more complex. So we started out just trying to affect light emissions, and then we just started, then we tried to see if we could make plants grow faster. We have done many, many studies of water. And we've also done big studies looking at lowering violence in war-torn areas. And of our 27 experiments to date, 23 have had measurable, positive, mostly significant effects. So let me unpack that a little bit and just talk about some of the more interesting experiments we've done. With one of our experiments, and we ran this 12 times, we wanted to see whether or not we can send intention to make seeds grow faster. And of course, that would have big implications in the world because it would mean that we can help make food grow more plentifully. So what we did was we worked with scientists, a whole lab at the University of Arizona, and they set up four sets of seeds with each experiment, four sets of 30 seeds. And so one was going to be the target and the three others controls. But it's important in experiments like this to never let the scientists know which one is the target. So that's what's considered to be a blinded experiment. The scientists don't know which one is the target. So I ran this experiment six times. Five times in front of audiences, when I would speak around the world, I would set up an experiment and have the audience do this with me. And once over the internet, where I invited my whole readership to send intention to these seeds. And so what we would do is randomly choose one of the four, and we send intention to that photograph. Now remember too, just get this, we were not sending intention to the seeds themselves. In every instance, we were simply sending intention to the photograph of the seeds, because the scientists would send me four sets of photographs, and I would show the photographs to my audience. We'd choose one randomly, and we'd send intention to that photograph representing those seeds. So the first time I ran this, I was in Sydney, Australia, and I, in front of an audience of 700. And the seeds, of course, are sitting back in Tucson, Arizona, thousands and thousands of miles away. Nevertheless, with each of the six experiments that we did, the seed sent intention always grew significantly higher than the control. Because what would happen is after we'd send intention, we would just tell the scientists, we're done, and they would plant this, all four sets of seeds and then just measure them. And it would only be after they measured them that I would unblind the study and tell them which ones we sent intention to. They also ran six controls just to make sure it was very well controlled, where all four sets of seeds would be planted. One would be designated the intention seeds, but they would not be sent intention. So they were kind of controls of the controls. And again, whenever we had intention studies, all seeds grew more than they did with the control studies, the non-intention studies. But the seeds that grew the highest of all were always the ones that were sent intention. So we actually published that. We presented it in front of a scientific group and published it. So that was one really interesting one with huge implications about the whole idea of a psychic intranet. I mean, the idea that, you know, you can just send an intention to a representation of somebody and or something, and that will have an effect. And also that it doesn't matter how far you are from the target, because we were halfway around the world in Sydney, Australia. Other times I was in Dallas and in Rhinebeck, New York, and South Carolina and Los Angeles, always miles away from the target, which was always in Tucson, Arizona. But we'd still have this effect. So we moved on to water, and we looked at we did all kinds of controlled experiments trying to purify polluted water, and finally did it out in the field at Lake Biwa in Japan. We took two samples of polluted water, sent intention to one of them, measured their pH and their light emissions before and afterward using the equipment of Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, who is a Russian physicist who's perfected a device called the GDV device, which is a gas discharge galvanization, is what it stands for. But essentially what it does is excites photons hundreds of thousands of times so it can record their activity. So it's basically doing what Fritz Popp did, but with newer equipment. And so we found we had a significant effect there, sending intention to polluted water to clean it up. But the most compelling of all, I think, of our experiments were four of them that we ran trying to lower violence. In 2008, we sent intention to Sri Lanka, to a portion of Sri Lanka, during the time when it was undergoing a civil war. And it was fascinating. But our intention, right after our intention, deaths fell by 48%, injuries by 74%. But we also discovered, I mean, it was really interesting. We sent intention through an entire week. We discovered that that very week seemed to be pivotal, because after that week, the government won a few important battles. Within 3 months, reclaimed an area that had been held by the rebels for years. And then 5 months later, that 25-year war was over. And when we had a professor of statistics do an analysis of the violence levels from 2 years before to several months after our experiment, modeling what should have happened based on what had happened on the past, there was definitely a long-term lowering of violence. So that was interesting, but if you do one experiment like that, it's meaningless. It could be total coincidence. There's 100 reasons why that could have happened that have nothing to do with intention. So we did it again in 2011 for the 10th anniversary of 9/11, sending intention to two provinces in southern Afghanistan, which had been the most violent during the war. And we got information from NATO several months after. We waited patiently about 3.5 months after the intention to then find out what happened. And there was a 790% drop in violence in just those two provinces in the month after our intention, and a long-term drop in those provinces in particular as compared to the rest of the country. So that was quite interesting. And the final thing we did was we had two experiments sending intention to what I guess could be considered the most violent place in America, which is the U.S. Congress. We sent intention to a couple of the counties right around the Congress, which had a lot of violence. And we again looked at police statistics from 2 years before to a year afterward and found a 33% drop in violence in those areas. Sadly, I guess it didn't extend to the Congress in the long term, but we did find that violent crime went down by 33%. Property crime did not. And remember, we were focusing just on violent crime, so that was quite compelling. But also, something else that was quite interesting, the day after our first intention experiment, John Boehner, who was or is the Speaker of the House, hugged Nancy Pelosi, who was a Democrat. He's a Republican. She's a Democrat. And she was the former speaker, and they were hated enemies. But they hugged each other the day after our experiment, so we wondered whether we really did have some sort of effect.
Absolutely
don't know.
Fascinating. Absolutely yes. Fascinating. So if we turn that now, very, very interesting, if we turn that now to sort of considering personal healing from illness, is an intention, if we consider the placebo effect, which is obviously a belief and expectation in recovery, are we saying that is a very similar thing to an intention? Is there an overlap there and it's working the same way? Because that's a huge sort of support for the idea of mind over matter, obviously.
Absolutely, and there's so much support for it. I mean, there's the placebo effect, and, you know, doctors always kind of poo-poo the placebo. They say, oh, it's only the placebo effect. You know, only the placebo effect. The placebo works about 60 to 70% of the time. No drug works as well as the placebo effect. That's how powerful it is. And a lot of doctors will actually give patients sugar pills, which is what a placebo is, because they know that the expectation of healing the doctor telling them this will help you is so powerful that it can, you know, mobilize the body's ability to heal. And, you know, they found that even when patients were told that it was a placebo, they would still get better because there was the doctor giving it to them, the expectation of healing. All of that is really suggesting it's really the power of the mind in most cases. So I think that intention is probably the most powerful placebo there is. Let me distinguish it between what intention is versus what a placebo is. I mean, a placebo is, as I say, something given that is a sugar pill. It has no active agent. But in taking it, the patient gets better. And, you know, they've not only demonstrated this with pills, but they had a really interesting study in Texas, in, I think, Houston, a Houston hospital, where some doctors took patients with arthritis of the knee. And half of them were given arthroscopy, where the knee was opened and cleaned out. And the others were given a sham experiment, where they, a sham operation, where they were just opened up and shut. You know, they did that nothing, the doctors didn't do anything to them. And they discovered that both patients, both sets of patients, improved in the same rate. And in fact, the patients where they had the dummy procedure had less pain in every regard. So that would suggest that the mind, whenever there is an expectation of healing, the mind can affect healing, even if it's a sham operation. But when I talk about intention, so a placebo is an intention trick. It's basically telling the patient, I'm going to make you better, and here's a drug that will do it, or here's an operation that will do it. With intention, it is your own or somebody else's very specific request to the universe to heal you. And what we've discovered in, I mean, I've not only done these big intention experiments, but I run workshops all the time and master classes in intention where we get into small groups and send intention to people who are ill. And we find that the, you know, just the intention of the group to heal that person can really work. What we've also found is the more specific, the better. So a lot of times when you, and this is also what distinguishes, I think, intention from prayer. You know, if with prayer, it's sort of, thy will be done. You know, you decide how it's going to work and what will happen to me. With intention, you're putting out a, it's almost like putting in your order to the restaurant. You know, I'd like this place. And we found that, as I say, the more specific, the better. You know, our intention is that Jane Doe be healed of all pain or free of all pain in her right hip and be healthy and well in every way. You know, just focusing on what needs to be done and then maybe making a global statement as well seems to work really well.
Amazing. So I think this is very important because it's a kind of message to patients about, it's almost like the prerequisite to recovery. I suppose when it comes to a chronic complex illness, it's still a prerequisite, but there's sort of, there are other things that obviously can be impacting that. So it's, I would sort of put a note of caution to people who then go, we create a whole own reality and sort of discount all these other factors that can be affecting them. So they might get a good healing response for a while, but maybe they truly are gluten intolerant, so it might last for, say, a month, and then they'll need to actually, the healing will disappear because they actually still need to get rid of gluten, I suppose. So I suppose it's, I'm thinking, in my view, if someone needs to sort of stand in the middle of Ken Wilber's four dimensions of reality, his four quadrant model, set the intention and then be aware about everything that could be sabotaging that in those four dimensions. I just wondered if you had anything you'd comment on with that.
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of things that do sabotage intention, yourself mainly. First of all, I think it's important to recognize and move beyond the whole masters of the universe view of intention. You know, you're one speck in a very big, giant superorganism. And, or another way of looking at that is you are vast and expanded to every, at the furthest reaches of the cosmos, because you are part of an enormous intergalactic superorganism. in my latest book, The Bond, by the way, I've got a sixth book. And in my latest book, The Bond, I've written extensively about how we are physically and also even behaviorally affected by the sun. They've shown demonstrations that when there's a lot of solar activity, heart attacks increase, epileptic fits increase. You know, we're essentially energetically destabilized. But there's also been studies showing that our behavior is affected. When there's certain solar activity during cycles, there's more terrorist activity. The stock market changes according to solar activity. You know, all kinds of things like that. So we're affected in big ways by lots of things. So one has to keep that in mind. But the biggest sabotager of all is ourselves. Remember I talked about the fact that we're sending out a tiny current of light. Well, it seems to be the case that our thoughts are one more light emission. And if you think about it, we are leaky buckets. And I demonstrate this in my workshops all the time, where people can send intention to each other and they pick it up. You know, a perfect stranger will pick up what they sent to them. So we're leaky buckets, and the issue is really what we're sending all the time, because most people aren't filled with and beaming out positive thoughts. You know, they're full of judgment, they're full of, you know, hate for themselves, they're full of self-loathing, they're full of all kinds of self-sabotage. And basically everything, every judgment they hold, all that flotsam and jetsam going through their heads, every last mendacious thought, that also gets beamed out to the universe, and that essentially becomes their life's intention. So I think it's really important for people to recognize that what they're beaming, what they're broadcasting to the world is what they're broadcasting to their bodies. There's that. There's also the power of the past to take us over like an unwanted guest. And with this, I'm going to really refer to my husband's book, The Untrue Story of You, which is all about this. And he's created a model, a three-self model, that talks about the biggest self and the bully of the other selves being the past. And that we aren't really, you know, the past, we think we are a something, but the past, a lot of the misunderstood experience, kind of creates our sense of what I am. And that often can be erroneous, and that often can take us over and account for all kinds of illness. So, the past can be the biggest sabotager of all. And then, of course, there's our relationships to other people that are also can sabotage us if we don't, you know, stay strong in our own intention.
Fascinating. Absolutely superb. That ties in exactly with everything we're finding on the summit as well. So it links in with what Dr. Roland McCrady was saying about how we most definitely, there are energy vampires are real. And that if we're going to hang out with people like that, you know, we've got to have our boundaries in place. The past, hugely important. So adverse childhood events are gigantic impact directly and via behavior too.
Yes, and I'll throw my little two cents into the ring on this one. First of all, I think really important, a really essential element here is to distinguish between mind and brain. Because if you're talking about just limbic remodeling, what you're basically saying is all your thoughts are residing in that, you know, that are part of that limbic system, and that changing thoughts is a matter of changing that. I think my own model is there's something very different in the sense that all of the evidence I've amassed in the field and all of my books, The Intention Experiment and The Bond, all suggest that mind does not reside in the brain. Certainly there was really, really compelling evidence from the work of the late Carl Pilgrim, a neuroscientist, demonstrating that memory does not reside in any particular address in the brain. It seems to be globalized, but moreover, it seems to be outside the brain. And then you start looking at, all you need to do is look at all of the evidence on near-death experiences and coma victims. And I look at them a lot because I think they're very, very compelling, because they really suggest that during the time, you know, these are all experiences where someone had not just what happened with the dark, you know, the dark tunnel and the light and all of that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the person having complete recall of everything that happened to him in the hospital or wherever when he was supposedly clinically dead. I mean, there was a fascinating story of a Dutch person who had had a Dutch guy who had been run over, and he came to the hospital and he was pronounced dead. And of course, when they do that, then they throw his clothes and everything on what's called the crash cart, and they start, you know, trying to revive him. And they managed after some time to do so. So the next day when he saw the doctor, he said to the doctor, "Could you ask that pretty blonde nurse who took my teeth out if she could give them back to us?" Now, that was, and my clothes, that was the point with the crash cart and everything, where the guy had been pronounced clinically dead. So where's mind then? His brain was not operating. Same thing with the work of Evan Alexander, who had one of the longest near-death experiences and wrote about it in Proof of Heaven. You know, he was aware of so much during the whole time. There could have been no way that was a hallucination. His brain was not functioning to all intents and purposes during that long, long coma. So these kinds of things tend to suggest, and much, much other evidence, that mind does not reside in brain. So if that's the case, if mind with placebo or mind is changing the body, what's going on here? And I would suggest that mind is reconfiguring the body, not the body reconfiguring the mind.
Absolutely. Yeah, brilliantly put. Couldn't agree more. I guess perhaps just as a final sort of comment and sort of question to you here, and the other thing I've observed in clinical practice is when somebody set the intention and it's all going great and they're in alignment and they're not self-sabotaging, they've kind of cleared the shadow work and they're doing what they need to do on the physical side. And actually when that happens, it's certain things that then happen that are actually a sign of things working, but the patient can view it as everything going wrong. So, and this seems to be the other sort of main sabotage that can happen. So it can actually be something that's working, but they're interpreting it like it's not working. So I think we've got this Herring's law of cure, which is if the intention's working and the body's healing, you've got often a return of old symptoms in the reverse order that they were originally experienced. And we see this with fatigue patients. They might have a return of the virus they had at the beginning of the illness that triggered it. And what they do is the virus comes up and they think, oh my gosh, the treatment's not working, I'm going backwards, and have a massive stress and assume it's not working, and actually very sadly and tragically, because they don't understand this, will actually collapse again and go into a stress. I wanted to share that for the sake of the audience. So very important.
That's so interesting, and it's so, I mean, we hear it from my work with What Doctors Don't Tell You. We find that over and over again, with different alternative types of modalities, they describe the exact same thing, where the patient, in getting better, re-experiences the early symptoms. And so I guess this comes to the power of the transaction between the practitioner, the healer, and the healee, because I think that's another element that's so important, almost essential, in the healing process. When the person is working with someone, and I saw that firsthand in the 1980s when I was ill and I couldn't find what was wrong with me. I had a collection of symptoms that are pretty, you know, they're pretty ho-hum these days. I had candida and mercury in my mouth, mercury poisoning, and undiagnosed allergies as a result, and a lot of things, but my whole system was going completely haywire, and no one could get me better. No doctors knew what was wrong with me. I started going to all kinds of alternative practitioners, and no one was getting me better. It was kind of a little early over here in the UK for the candida diagnosis. But ultimately, I found a nutritional pioneer, brilliant man, Dr. Stephen Davies, who was the most amazing healing agent himself. He would just focus so much on the patient that I was so amazed by the healing transaction that went on, that he treated me like an equal partner. You know, there was me, him, and the condition, and we were going to sort out that condition together. And he gave me so much hope all the time that I realized that half the reason I got better was not just the diet and all of the things that I went through and the getting rid of allergens. It was the relationship with him and his encouragement, belief, you know, hope, all of those things that he was transmitting to me all the time.
Fantastic. Very interesting. So, yeah, the confidence and the trust that the practitioner can give, including helping somebody go through, for, if they are experiencing the Herring's Law, it's just calmly explaining to them what it is, so that almost getting them to expect that, not to worry if it comes. So you just sort of go, oh, it's, I've just had a what looks like a relapse, and actually it's, I'm on my way to recovery.
Exactly. And that's down to the communication powers and the, you know, the hope generated by the practitioner. Because, you know, the bottom line, I think, is one of the worst things that conventional doctors can do is give somebody a death sentence, you know, give somebody the diagnosis, well, you've got 3 months to live now. That is, first of all, ridiculous, because no one can say with any certainty how someone will respond to the challenge of healing and who is going to live and who is going to die. But secondly, and it's also variable, but secondly, in a sense, he's creating the diagnosis. So I think one of the biggest medicines of all, even bigger than the placebo effect, even bigger than intention, is the power of hope.
Fascinating. That very, yep, agreed. Very interesting. Lynn, thank you so much for sharing your time. It's been a fascinating discussion. Please share with the audience where they can find out more about you and your books, and also this fantastic resource, which is the What Doctors Don't Tell You, where you talk about all this kind of stuff all the time, presumably.
We have so much on chronic fatigue and all kinds of areas in medicine, just about everything. We've been running, by the way, for 25 years, and we, for the last 3 years, we're a magazine now, and we're in 10 countries around the world, including the U.S. and the U.K., but people can find out more about that at www.wddty.com, and that WDDTY stands for What Doctors Don't Tell You, and we have a 25-year searchable database for, with very, very specific ways of treating just about every illness you can imagine, the right supplements, the right, you know, diet, etc., the right herbal medicine, all kinds of things like that. For me, it's www.lynnmctaggart.com, and my name is spelled with an E on the end of Lynn and A-R-T. And that will include all kinds of information about my 6 books and my last 3 books, The Field, The Intention Experiment, and The Bond, and also the workshops and teleseminars and speaking engagements that I give all around the world.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Lynn. It's been fantastic. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think the audience would have got a lot out of that. And I'm sure they'll be following up more on your work as well.